Hi, Michaela Lafrac here. The podcast you are about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. This town meeting day, Vermonters had to wrestle with whether they could shoulder significant property tax increases to support their local schools. We're talking nearly 20% increases here. Many school districts did not fare well. Nearly one in three school budgets failed on town meeting day. Later in today's show, we're going to hear directly from superintendents in districts where the budgets were voted down. We'll also speak with the chair of the House Committee on Education on the state's role in all of this. This morning, I spoke with the superintendent of Mount Abraham Unified School District in Addison County, Patrick Reen. Their budget did not pass. I asked Patrick to explain what happened.
Of course, I'm disappointed the budget didn't pass. But I also understand why our community voted no. It's a big ask. It was a 15% tax rate increase, give or take, which is for us, you know, nearly $1,000 on a $300,000 home. That's a big raise on top of what are currently pretty high property taxes. And our taxpayers aren't getting more for that raise. They're keeping the same. It's a level service budget. So they're
briefly, can you explain what you mean by level service budget?
Yeah. So the budget that we put forward for next year has all the same programming and personnel that we have in our current year. So this added cost doesn't come with an increase in personnel in our schools to meet student needs. You know, we're looking at, you know, around 16% increase in health insurance premiums, and the district pays 80% of that premium increase. So that's a big number. You know, salaries go up and the cost of everything goes up. So there's definitely an inflation aspect to the cost going up. And on top of that, we have revenue going away, like the ESSER funds that are sunsetting effectively at the end of this fiscal year. And I think what our taxpayers are saying is simply, we have no more to give. Even if we want to, we just don't have it to give. So I hear that context. Unfortunately, it comes at a time when student needs remain high. Academic needs, behavioral needs, mental health needs are still high. You know, the impact of the pandemic has not gone away. We're still working at it, but it's still certainly present. It's really, really hard. It has definitely changed the way I interact in the community and my relationship within those communities. And when you're the face of some of those hard decisions and big ideas, that can be really tough.
But it wasn't just Mount Abe's school budget that was voted down. A proposal to spend more than $1 million to buy the school district's central office building in Bristol was also rejected by residents. The current owner is looking to sell the building.
So we have no idea if the new buyer is going to be interested in leasing or if they are looking to take over the space for their own needs. The purchase of this building is the least expensive and least disruptive option for us. And that's why we were pursuing that. So we have the money, but the board needed the authority from the electorate to make the purchase. So that failed pretty handily by essentially a 2-to-1 margin. So we're left with only more expensive options to pursue as sort of finding a new home for our central office space. So the cost to upfit, say, a space in one of our school buildings is greater than the cost to purchase this building.
So was there like a disconnect in like communication there? Like, I feel like since people's main concern right now is cost effectiveness, why would they vote it down if it's going to cost them more in the end?
I think there was a disconnect. I don't think people necessarily understood, despite efforts to communicate it. I don't think people understood that saying no to the purchase of this building isn't a cost savings measure. I suspect people thought if they say no to the purchase of the building that it would save dollars. It actually likely costs more dollars. And I don't think people understood that, again, despite efforts by the board to make that point clear.
The Mount Abe School Board will now need to go back to the drawing board to try to cut costs and present a new plan. Joining me now to discuss all of this is Vermont Public's education reporter, Lola Dufour. She's been covering the school budget debates for weeks now. Lola, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Michaela.
Yeah, so we just started off by hearing from Mount Abe's Superintendent Patrick Reed. He covered a lot of points there. And he'd also told me in our conversation that Vermont has lost about 1,000 students per year for the past 20 years. I didn't have a chance to fact check those numbers, but generally that decline in young students is certainly true. We also still have the same number of school buildings and superintendent offices, and those facilities come with significant repair costs. I was just really struck by those numbers. For you, Lola, how does this overall decline in the number of students in Vermont over these past few decades affect the cost per student today and all these issues with budgets that we're facing?
Right. I mean, that's really one of, if not the key question. We have one of the highest, perhaps the highest, but I want to hedge a little bit, per pupil costs in the country. Our system is kind of inherently inefficient. And I think superintendents are increasingly concerned that we have a system that is able to do less with more, right? And you heard that from Patrick Green, right, saying, I'm asking my residents to give me an extra $1,000 a year, and I'm presenting a level funded budget, or you know, one with level services, and you know, that's because generally we're trying to replicate services in a bunch of different buildings that are serving fewer and fewer students. Addison County is actually a really interesting area and microcosm for this, because the local superintendents there have been trying really hard to sell consolidation to their local communities, and they've been kind of eaten alive. I mean, local voters tend to say no emphatically to closing local schools. And I've been kind of really startled at the number of superintendents this year that I've heard testify to lawmakers to say, look, we need state level leadership on this issue here, because folks at the local level are really unwilling to make these tough decisions. And one more point, right? And I think the kind of, you know, having to buy the building is sort of a weird kind of singular situation, but I think it also points to the fact, this kind of broader problem, which is that, you know, the way we fund schools is super complicated. And then we also have, you know, hyperlocal control, and kind of explaining really complicated systems to people every year, you know, can sometimes occasionally lead to situations where people don't fully understand how things are interacting.
I should also note that you mentioned all the different school districts in Addison County. There's four school districts in that county alone. And to your last point, Lola, we just got an email from a listener, Jay, who writes, we need to consolidate to a statewide school board. This will reduce administrative costs and give us a statewide calendar and stronger purchasing power. And listeners, if you have thoughts today, shoot us an email at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. You can also call us at 800-639-2211. Our lines are open right now. Lola, let's zoom out here for a second. 29 out of the 93 school budgets failed on town meeting day. That's around a third. Help us put that number in context. How does it compare to previous years?
It's really, really, really bad. It may be historic, but once again, I need to hedge a little bit just because record keeping gets a little sketchy when you go back. But, you know, it might be the worst. It's certainly the worst year that anyone I've talked to so far can remember. You know, for comparison, if you look at the last 10 years, the worst year was in 2014 when 14% of budgets failed, you know, and we're looking at roughly 30% this year. So, and, you know, also interesting, 2014 was the year that preceded the passage of Act 46, right? So when it was half this bad, you know, we tried a major reform. And so I think that kind of gives you a sense of the kind of inflection point we might be looking at here.
Yeah.
Well, we have some calls coming in. We also just got an email from a listener named Ruth who writes, it will be easy for many to react to efforts to cut classroom teacher positions. This is the wrong reaction. In my opinion, your average Vermonter such as myself with three school-aged children strongly supports our education system, but sees it becoming more and more top-heavy and districts being run like large corporations. The first place to look for pay and position cuts should always be with non-direct student service positions, such as in administrations. Lola, do you think that this is a place that, you know, these school boards are going to start looking for these cuts, the ones that have to go back to the drawing board?
Sure. Although, actually, you have less control over your central office. Over your central office spending, particularly if you have a bunch of like little school districts. And this is kind of gets to the complexity of Vermont's school system. But right. Like if you want to maintain a bunch of small independent school districts, you need to you need a lot of superintendents. Right. And so actually, I think you might hear some superintendents agree with you that like, yeah, there could be, fewer of us, but that's going to require larger kind of consolidation that folks may still be uncomfortable with.
Mm. Well, prior to town meeting day, we had Sue Siglowski on Vermont Edition. She's the head of the Vermont School Board Association. And she told us that, you know, some of these key reasons that school budgets had grown were rising costs of health insurance, staff salaries and benefits, like we're talking about, inflation, and the loss of pandemic-era federal funding. And she was really trying to make this case to voters all across the state that these budget increases were tough but necessary. Now, you spoke to her recently, Lola. What was her reaction to what happened on town meeting day?
Yeah. So I actually want to like sort of push back a tiny bit. She was definitely making the point that like there is a lot out of the control of schools, right? You just have these crazy inflationary pressures. Healthcare is obscene and growing. But I don't think she was necessarily arguing that, look, this is the bill, there is no other way, and you just have to vote yes. Mm-hmm. And that kind of goes back to the message I got from her and also Jeff Francis, who is the head of the Superintendent's Association. We talked after the votes had come in on Wednesday. And, you know, she said, look, as we look for another way to do things, because they agree and believe that the status quo is not tenable, you know, they really made the point that we need to actually understand why schools are so expensive. They want people to understand that if we continue to ask schools to do more and more, particularly in the area of like social services and mental health, and we want to maintain a bunch of very small school districts and very small schools, and we want to continue to rely on the same funding mechanisms, that yes, this is the bill. Like, that's just what it costs. But they're not necessarily saying, like, don't change any part of that equation. They're just saying, like, we need to understand how all of these parts of the equation interact with one another, right? And so just wanted to add, like, a little bit of nuance there.
Yeah. No, thank you for that. Now, Lola, 10 school districts postponed their votes. They didn't vote on their school budgets on Tuesday, on town meeting day. Why? And when will they vote?
Yeah, they'll vote later, before April 15th. And the reason that they postponed was because, you know, there are a lot of reasons why school budgets are going up this year. And then one variable, one reason that lawmakers and the governor were particularly concerned about was, you know, they worried that this tax break that had been baked in, this temporary tax break that had been baked into a previous retooling of the education finance formula, was actually encouraging a lot of school districts to maximize one-time spending this year. And so kind of at the 11th hour, they passed this bill to eliminate that tax break, to remove that incentive, and also allow school districts to postpone their budgets. Now, as you mentioned, 10, and I actually think that number's been revised downwards a little bit. We have new numbers from the Vermont Superintendents Association. But, very few school districts actually took advantage of that. I think partly because it came so late in the game. Mm-hmm. You know, I talked to one school board chair yesterday who said, early voting had already started. We didn't feel like we could actually, put out a new budget yet. That being said, some school districts did take some spending out in response to that bill, even without delaying. And what that piece of legislation has done is also kind of like restored this linear relationship between a school district spending and its tax rate. When that tax break was still in place, you had this kind of like weird bizarro world situation where some school districts found themselves in the scenario where they could like add or subtract millions of dollars from their budget and their tax rate wouldn't budge. So the kind of one silver lining from for school districts who have failed budgets is that now with this new bill in place, at least if they cut money from their budget, mm-hmm. when they re-present it to voters, they'll actually be able to, show a commensurate, reduction in their tax rate. Mm. That's complicated.
No, but, we're very appreciative that you have your head on this and understand it better than many of us do, myself included. Lola, I want to make sure we hit what's going on in Cabot, because it's an interesting situation over there. Cabot residents voted on town meeting day to keep their high school open. Fewer than 40 students attend the high school now. Can you tell us a bit more about what happened? And is it a unique situation or something that's kind of being mirrored in some of these smaller districts across the state?
Yeah, it's not unique at all. Cabot is somewhat unique in that I think it's one of the few remaining pre-K-12 schools, like standalone schools where you have all the grades. But it is not unusual in that it is, a very small school. And we have a lot of those. And once again, local voters said, no, we are going to keep this school open. We really value it in our community. There was kind of an added wrinkle in Cabot, which is that the option before voters was, go to close the high school and tuition out students, right? Go to full school choice. And the school board, was against this measure. This was petitioned by local voters. And, they made this really they really leaned on the argument that, look, the only thing more expensive than a really small school is school choice. So if you want your, tax rate to go down, actually don't vote down. Don't vote to close the school. That being said, this is the fourth time that Cabot has considered whether or not to close its high school in 11 years. Mm. And the school board chair that I spoke to there said, look, we're tired of having this conversation. If the school remains open and our voters reject this, the school board's not going to rest on its laurels. We know we need to have broader conversations about what education looks like here, including with neighboring communities. And so I think, even though that school remained open, I think there's going to be big conversations ongoing in Cabot and in the rest of the state, right?
Yeah. Well, let's bring in some callers here before we let you go, Lola. We have John in Stratford on the line. John, you're on the air. What are your thoughts?
Hi.
Hey, John, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
All right, go ahead.
Recently in the state of Vermont, cannabis and online gambling have become legal. Both are sort of windfall tax revenue for the state. And I'm wondering why those monies can't be used to help school funding.
Mm. Yeah, thanks for your comment, John. I know that the money, the tax revenue from those is typically directed towards, something that's kind of related, like for the gambling, it's funding support services for people who have gambling addictions, but has there been any talk of kind of shifting that funding towards something that's clearly a need, like schools?
Yeah, well, I mean, for example, cannabis already pays partly for after school, right? Mm. So I'd say, A, that money is all mostly already spoken for, and B, even though it's more money, it's not a lot of money compared to what schools cost.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, property taxes are not going to be saved by cannabis revenues. Mm-hmm. Or gambling revenues, for that matter.
Education reporter Lola Dufour, really appreciate you coming on. We'll have to return to this conversation soon. There's so much more to talk about, but thank you again for your time today.
Yeah, of course.
Nearly a third of all school budgets failed to pass on town meeting day. That's because Vermonters were asked if they could shoulder nearly double-digit property tax increases to support their schools. Today on the show, we're talking about what comes next for these school districts and their residents. Now, before I introduce our next guest, let's take a couple more callers. We have John in Stratford on the line. John, we meant to take you a bit earlier. I apologize. You're on now. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks so much. One of the things Rebecca Holcomb and Jim Mazin, our representatives, mentioned at our informational meeting was the effect of all the other programs besides preschool through 12 education that are now in the education fund. Those, you know, when Act 60 first started 30-some years ago, it was only to fund K through 8 education. And the problem is there's a host of other programs that either the superintendents or Lola could mention that are now being paid for by property taxes, school property taxes, but the only cuts that can be, and the legislature put them in there, primarily because they are sort of school-related and they didn't have to raise other funding to cover it. Mm. But now the only cuts that can be made, since there's all these other programs, is cutting our schools themselves, and it's really unfair. Mm. And what would be a good thing is if all the other programs that are in the educational fund that aren't directly K through pre-K through 12 spending cover those costs, get out of the educational fund, and school property taxes actually be school property taxes.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, thanks so much for your call. And I want to get the thoughts of a couple superintendents who we have on the line with us now. They're both in districts where residents voted down their school budgets on Tuesday. First, we have with us Brooke Olson Farrell, with Slate Valley Unified School District, which includes Fairhaven, Castleton, Benson, and Orwell. Brooke, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. And we are also joined today by Ryan Harity. He's the superintendent for the Lamoille South Supervisory Union, which includes Elmore, Morristown, and Stowe. Stowe postponed its budget vote, but in Elmore and Morristown, the budgets failed. Ryan, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, I'd like to hear from both of you kind of just how you're feeling a couple of days out from town meeting day, if the results were what you expected, or you still kind of reeling from these votes. Brooke, let's start with you.
I'm honestly not surprised. Of course, I'm disappointed, but there needs to be a lot of work done in the state in supporting our public education system and our taxpayers. And we have a very conservative district that has historically voted down budgets on and off for decades. So, you know, we respect the taxpayer voice and are looking forward to regrouping and moving forward.
And Ryan, how about you? How are you feeling?
Well, you know, we're a little bit disappointed. You know, we had 900 yes votes and 922 no votes. Oof. So it was a very slim margin there. I agree with Brooke that there needs to be a lot of work done in the state of Vermont around our public education system and really thinking about what is being put into that system and what districts are being expected to pay for on an annual basis.
And Ryan, you kind of have a unique situation there where Elmore and Morristown did not pass their budget. Stowe decided to push their vote. Can you kind of explain what the situation is there, why your supervisor union is a bit unique compared to some others?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think we're an interesting case study. I think if you want to look at how education finance is playing out across the state, Elmore and Morristown were slated to be a beneficiary of the state's new funding system, Act 127, and they were to receive about a 5% increase in their share of the education fund. However, the way that that has played out in reality is that we haven't been able to pass a budget because of the tax pressure that we're experiencing from just the overall increase in education spending across the state. And the way that plays out is when the education spending goes way up, then the property yield goes down, and the property yield is used to determine our tax rate. And so even though in theory we were slated to be a beneficiary, the reality is that Elmore and Morristown will have to make significant reductions to our budget. And, you know, in turn, it will have some pretty detrimental consequences on our students.
Hmm. Yes, Ryan, go ahead. Were you about to say something?
I was just going to add, and Stowe is also unique because in Stowe, we walked into the budget planning process with a 24% estimated property tax increase. And for us to reduce even a penny on our tax rate, we would have to go below our current fiscal year budget by over $100,000. And so obviously that wasn't an option. And so we were looking at our budget, and we had at the time recently a bond failure. So there was a $40 million bond to improve the facilities in Stowe. If anybody has been in our schools there, you'll understand that those schools have not had any significant capital investment since the 1970s when they were built. And so the schools are very old and aging, and we have a lot of issues there. We've had students that have had to be evacuated recently because of gas leaks. We have leaky roofs. We have parking lot challenges, a lot that we need to invest in. And so because of our tax pressure there, we ended up delaying our vote and making a reduction to our budget, because with the 5% tax cap removal, our property tax increases would have been around 40%. Hmm. And so now we're looking at a 27% property tax increase. And what's frustrating for both Elmore, Morristown, and Stowe is that our education spending in EMU, which is what we call it, is only 7% increase. And our education spending mm-hmm. in Stowe is only a 9% increase. Mm-hmm. And, you know, still we're looking at these, you know, significant property tax increases, which is, you know, is really hard on our community right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Brooke Olson-Farrell, I'm curious, you know, hearing Ryan talk about these strains and kind of this really impossible situation so many folks in Vermont have been put in this year, what have your conversations been like out in the community with parents, with colleagues? You know, is these school districts are making this big ask, but one that, you know, for you really feels necessary and pressing?
Yeah, so we've done a tremendous amount of outreach with the community, from having coffee at the local diners, you know, to attending select board meetings and, you know, having conversations even at the town transfer stations. But what we're seeing overall is people just don't feel like they can afford the cost of education in our community, which is super frustrating. I mean, I understand it, but we have one of the lowest spending per pupils in the state. We had less than 1% increase in education spending in this proposed budget that went down. Our education spending per long-term weighted ADM is $11,384. So again, one of the lowest in the state, and yet we have trouble passing budgets in this district. I also think there's a huge disconnect in terms of how people understand the education funding formula and how people think education is funded. And we're constantly up against the misinformation that's out there on social media. And that has been very, very challenging for us to contend with.
What are you hearing? What do people think is going on?
I think that they are not necessarily understanding that when education spending increases in the state, it has a direct impact on our local school district, in which we can't necessarily control that locally. And so that's been that's been challenging. I think there's still a lot of misunderstanding as a result of Act 46 and the merger and how school budgets are voted on and decided upon. So when taxpayers see an ask for a $31 million budget, where when they used to have a $6 million budget for their local school, it's been kind of an automatic no because it's just sticker shock.
Yeah.
So that's been hard. And then also seeing the relationship between Act 46 and actually our district has been able to decrease spending when you compare it to pre-Act 46. So Act 46 was a huge really win for our school district. Our tax rates were projected to be over $2, and they're $1.16, our equalized tax rate right now. So, I mean, so just a huge win for us. But we made some tough decisions and closed a school and consolidated.
Hmm. Well, I want to bring in some callers here with a lot of folks waiting patiently on the line. Ben in Westminster is next. Ben, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. My name's Ben, and I am dyslexic, and I'm also hyperactive, and both of my children are divergent learners and came through the Vermont school system. In my experience, we spend a lot of money on experts trying to prevent children from getting services, and that even though Vermont's done a really good job with a multi-tiered system and moving towards response to intervention, the fact is we're still applying a disabilities model to a situation which needs to actually be recognized as diversity, neurodiversity. And we could save so much money in the state of Vermont just by assuming that up to 30% of the population is going to need to be on a skills-based level instead of an age-based level. Mm-hmm. But
I'm going to jump in here because we don't have too much time, and I want to make sure that our guests can respond. Ryan Harity, I hear Ben saying that one way to reduce spending is around how we work with students with special needs. It's also a space that does currently take up a lot of money in school budgets right now. What are your thoughts?
You know, I think Ben brings up an excellent point. Yeah. And something that we've been talking a lot about in our district is, you know, a future return on investment versus, you know, a cost reduction right now. And, you know, if we have an interventionist that we put into our budget or we invest in our pre-K program, which is something that we've done significantly over the past few years, we're really making an investment not for today, but for 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road. And I think that's what Ben is probably alluding to. And so I agree with him 100%. I think what's challenging about that is when your district starts to face significant tax pressure, you have to start making these reductions. And your interventionists and the preventative services are not required by federal law, but special education services are. And so getting people to really understand that it's better to be preventative is very challenging in a tough tax pressure world.
Yeah, well, I also want to include one more thought from a listener via email. Andy in Dover says, how many school budgets would have failed if people could have amended the budget before voting on it? And now these votes can be used as justification by the state for more top-down control. Give the people a hammer and they will smash things. Give them a real decision-making tool and they will make good decisions, just maybe not the decisions that Montpelier wants them to make. Well, to Andy's point, residents have now had the chance to use that hammer and make some pretty tough decisions. And I'd like to hear in these last few moments with both of you, what comes next? You're both headed back to the drawing board. Brooke Olson Farrell, what's next for you?
So we put out a letter to the community yesterday, encouraging them to come forward and be engaged in the process. And that's one of the things that we've struggled the most with is that in engagement. So we have a board meeting Monday night where we're going to discuss what the next steps are. I mean, honestly, our budget failed by the largest margin since 2020 in our district. And again, I mean, we're a district with historical budget failure, so it's not necessarily a surprise, but really trying to engage with the community to get both sides to understand how we can move forward together.
And Ryan, what's next for you?
Well, I think there's our short-term steps, which are similar to Brooke's, soliciting feedback from our community. We're putting out a survey today to our community in Elmore and Morristown, and you know, just asking them, if you voted no, why? And tell us where you're at. And then on Monday, we'll be meeting to revisit our budget and make some decisions with the school board there. I think from a more global long-term visioning perspective, we really need to be working collaboratively across the state to design a better education funding model that meets the needs of all of our kids. Because right now we have a situation where some districts were able to easily pass their budgets and we'll see millions and millions of dollars that they can put towards services or new school buildings, and other districts are going to have to make these drastic reductions. And it's just, you know, it's not equitable.
Ryan Harity with Lamoille South Supervisory Union and Brooke Olson-Farrell with Slate Valley Unified School District. Thanks to both of you for joining us today. Representative Peter Conlin is a Democrat from Cornwall in Addison County, and he's the chair of the House Education Committee. Representative Conlin, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Now, you've been listening in to today's show. What do you think of the conversation so far, and in particular, the thoughts from the superintendents who we just heard?
It's conversations that have been going on before the vote and after the vote. A lot of what they've had to say certainly have heard repeatedly, and you can hear the real frustration in their voices. And when Brooke Olson-Farrell talks about that they do conservative budgeting in Fairhaven, where she is not kidding. They are a low-spending district, and they don't leave a lot of room to make any further cuts. So I think they're going to have a tough time when they go back. But it's a hard and frustrating situation, largely due to a big confluence of various impacts on our school districts.
Yeah. Well, one of those impacts that I keep hearing again and again from folks is that, you know, in the past couple of years, this federal funding that really came in during the pandemic into the states, much of which went to schools for various programs, has now gone away. It seems like people have sort of been like caught unawares by that. But didn't you as lawmakers know that that was going to happen?
Absolutely. And it's not just the direct payments to schools. All of that money that came to the state, not just to schools, but to towns and individuals and unemployment and all that, also churned within the economy and actually drove up the sales tax revenues, which helped offset property taxes in the education fund. But speaking specifically to the school district dollars, you know, the school districts, from my observations, largely spent that money on supports for students to help with learning loss, behavioral issues that were very apparent after COVID. And yes, those dollars came to an end. And yes, I think school districts were very aware that they were going to come to an end. The problem is that the student need did not. And I think that they see a great importance in continuing these investments. Not just an importance, but an obligation and an imperative to give students what they need in order to access their education.
Yeah, well, speaking of that imperative, just last month you told your committee mates that these property tax hikes indicate a major inflection point, crisis point, crossroads. Now that the votes are in, what do you make of your mandate?
Oh, I think that there's a strong mandate to really put everything on the table, right? We need to talk about everything. We need to take a relook at our funding system. We need to look at what it is we think we should have statewide as a school system. We've gotten a very sobering look at our school facilities. So I think our mandate is to both look short-term and long-term at some solutions, or at least some strategies to bend the cost curve.
Well, earlier today, as I mentioned at the top of the show, I spoke with the superintendent of the Mount Abraham Unified School District in Addison County, Patrick Green. And in describing all the costs that his school district is dealing with, he mentioned things that we've been discussing today, like inflation, construction, lots of repairs. And he also talked about how there's a lot of legislation that's getting passed that takes a major toll on his staff's time and budget. Let's take a listen.
You know, examples of current bills under consideration, you have S-204 literacy legislation, S-304, a bill requiring schools to provide students in grades 6-8 with career enrichment and exposure, S-284 cell phone legislation, S-187 sunscreen legislation. Those are just a few of the current pieces of legislation being considered that would impact schools in some way, something they have to manage or report on or somehow account for, which takes time, which means people, which ultimately means dollars.
Representative Conlon, what do you think of that concern about, in his phrasing, kind of over-legislating schools?
I think his concerns are absolutely justified, especially right now. I think we have to be very careful about the things that we pass, especially now while schools are still getting their footing from recovering from COVID. They're having troubles just day-to-day staffing every classroom. So I think his words are very important, and I think we have to be very careful. You know, at the same time, I would just say that things like literacy are extremely important, and our literacy scores in this state are not as good as they should be. And there have been commissioned studies about literacy in Vermont with well-reasoned, thought-out recommendations, not ones that were made by the legislature, but by the Vermont Literacy Council, for example. So we need to be very careful about striking that balance between what we are asking of our schools and what our schools are dealing with day to day. And I would say that we are definitely erring on the side of giving schools and school districts some room to breathe, some recovery time, and try to back out of some of these. You know, a perfect example would be the PCB testing program that was enacted in 2021. The House has never been a big fan of it anyway, but it's for those school districts that are affected by this, it takes a huge toll. And until we have a long-term funding and a greater idea of how this falls into all of our facilities needs, we're looking at a way to sort of wind that down and take that burden off schools.
Hmm. Well, we have Carolyn in Shelburne on the line with a question for you, Representative Conlon. Carolyn, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I was very interested in the point that a previous caller made. His name was John, and he said something to the effect of there are many programs in the education fund or school budgets that are fixed and don't really have to do directly with education K through 12 and that the school boards can't touch, which means when they need to redo their budgets, they really can only touch things that hurt education specifically. So my question is, what are those programs he was talking about? What is the percentage of those in the education fund or the school budgets or our property taxes? And is the legislature considering taking those out of our education costs and putting them in some other source of funding so that our property taxes are not so high and we can really dedicate them to proper education of our kids?
Mm, thank you, Carolyn. Representative Conlon.
So I couldn't give you a full laundry list, but they are very much connected to education. So, for example, we have an early college program that for qualifying entering seniors, they can take their last year of high school as a first year of college at one of our state colleges. That's an example of a very sort of pre-K to 12 adjacent education funded item. We have dual college, dual enrollment, which allows somebody to take courses at CCV or one of the state colleges that is also funded as part of their studies in order to get college credit. Those are two I can come up with. I'm not sure I can come up with a whole list more. I think in total, you know, the numbers are, they're not huge in comparison to the $2.3 billion spending that we do in education in general. Do they deserve another look? Absolutely. We have to, like I said, everything needs to be on the table, and maybe we need to rethink whether a program like Early College, which is funded right out of the Ed Fund, is a worthwhile program enough so that it should be continued to be funded that way.
A lot to consider here, Representative Conlin. It seems like this year has really been, this season, this town meeting day has really been an inflection point for Monners. We're really putting our heads on what goes into a school budget, in many ways for the first time for some of us. Do you feel like this is sort of a turning point?
Oh, I think there's no question. This is clearly a time that we need to relook at everything, including our funding formula, including what we're asking of our schools. You know, when we look at things like the student mental health needs that have frankly exploded, and starting before COVID, but then COVID just lit a fire on all of this, we're spending about $53 million in FY24 on mental health services for students. And this is really the salaries and benefits for folks like behavior interventionists, school counselors, social workers, those types of folks. Their numbers alone in the past 4 years have gone up from about 150 statewide to about 750 statewide. And that reflects the needs of students as they show up every day at the front door of the school. And the schools have, you know, a legal obligation and a moral imperative to provide them with what they need. Because, you know, that's sort of the service of last resort. And, that's a huge burden on school budgets. Perhaps it should be funded some other way. But for now, that's the system that we have. And it probably is the system that we need going forward. It's just expensive.
Well, that certainly has been proven this week during these town meeting day votes. Representative Peter Conlin, the chair of the House Education Committee, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck in the weeks ahead.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.